Mr. Sutherland?
If it pleases the court, this case is being appealed because Mark and Teresa Sullivan believe that their constitutional rights have been taken from them and that based upon the blanket immunity that was given to the caseworkers, we believe that that abrogates any responsibility or accountability for their constitutional violations. Without judicial approval, the defendants deliberately circumvented the review by the local court, trespassed onto the Sullivan property, and without probable cause of any claim of exigent circumstances, removed the very young child of Mark and Teresa Sullivan. The decision excuses constitutional violations that were so obvious the local court, the local judge, Dr. Delahanty, found that, one, there was no evidence to support probable cause, two, that if he had been approached by this department, he would not have found probable cause to issue the warrant, and three, after hearing a full review of the evidence that they had, he found no probable cause and ordered the child returned, and most critically, he found from the evidence that they had an opportunity to approach the court to obtain a warrant and deliberately chose not to. It must be remembered that the defendants, when they gave a deposition and when they were answering to what the sequence of events were, never claimed there was exigent circumstances, nor did they ever claim that they had probable cause. They only said that they had a suspicion that somebody, one of the adults having contact with the younger child, caused or may have caused this injury. There was a conflict in a lot of the evidence that was developed about what this really was. The officers that first investigated, we have an affidavit in the record, and they presented their report, their initial findings, to the Child Protective Services, that it looked like a bite mark to them. So if you look at the analysis of the Seventh Circuit and you look at Brokaw, for example, there isn't even any proof of a crime. There's proof of an injury, but, you know, when I grew up, that's just proof of living. You know, the playground, nicks and scars and bruises and bumps. This is an injury that could have occurred in any number of circumstances at the daycare center. What we find, I think, is that the trial judge in this particular case, in his very skimp opinion, devoted less than 3 pages to the legal analysis of this case. And that he did so by dissecting the Croft case and finding that there were many distinguishing factors between that case, which we felt gave some guidance to any caseworker or anyone else in their situation, that they were violating this person's constitutional rights, that there was no probable cause. As this court has found in a number of cases, particularly the Sheikh-Adhi case and also reiterated in Brokaw, when you're looking for exigent circumstances, the court requires that the standard be a stringent test. So it makes no sense to have an exception which would allow bypassing judicial review, which then permits this balancing analysis, which the court does want to take place for the benefit of the children and also for the benefit of the family and their interest in family integrity and family privacy. But when the scrutiny that the courts would use to determine whether there was exigent circumstances or an emergency is stringent, then it makes no sense to have a lesser standard for something less serious, such as these facts present. So when you look at the history of this case, the caseworkers present no affirmative statements that they believed there was any probable cause. They emphatically denied that there was any emergency or exigent circumstances. And this is reinforced by the deputy sheriffs who come to the scene at their request to assist in the removal of the minor child. Sheriff says, do you have a warrant? They said, no. They said, well, then we can't go in. So they're well informed about the law. And so they tried to essentially entice or persuade Mark Sullivan to come out, and he refuses to come out when he finds that there's no warrant. There is no question that he was coerced and Teresa was coerced into signing this contract, if you will, to allow them to take the younger child to the paternal grandmother in Ohio.
Would you just briefly summarize the 10? It's a Friday to a week ago Monday or whatever. It's 10 days from the first where the police come over to where the judge says no case. One of the things he did say was that, well, there was a long process here. It wasn't, and so he gives some credit to the, whatever you call them, the DCS, that they tried to go through a process and work their way through, and then they end up with Friday evening, and it's too late to get whatever they should have done a long time ago. But that was one of the differences between grabbing the kids and taking them out right away.
Well, that's a factual distinction, but it's not a constitutional distinction.
Well, when does the constitutional problem arise?
The constitutional problem arises when the caseworker is given license to ignore the judicial process and say, hey, I'm going to decide to remove the child no matter what evidence I have. And when questioned by the judge, the trial judge at the state court level, what are you basing this on? And she says, he had access. And he says, is that it? That's it. That's not evidence of a constitutional violation at all. That's not even evidence that there's a crime. It just means that the caseworker was acting on an assumption or a suspicion or a hunch, and that's it.
What does the record tell us about the severity of the injury to the child? You said it was a little playground thing when you grew up. I thought it was a fairly serious situation, and the opinion of everybody was that the injury, the bruising, had to have been caused by an adult.
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor. I think what happens is
Tell me what the severity of the injury was.
The mother discovers this when she's taking a bath, and it's an unexplained what she thinks is bruise or bite mark. She's not sure. She then talks to her husband and says, I don't know where it came from. I haven't, you took him to the daycare and you come back and, you know, we had dinner, we played, and now you're digging in a bath. So he calls his mother, who is a licensed daycare worker. She says, take him to the police. The police first examine it, and you have an affidavit in the record from Detective Bright. He thinks it's a bite mark from a child. And that happens at that age group pretty frequently. You have biters. That's how they act out. So it's nothing life-threatening. Not even sure the skin was broken. There's no evidence of that.
Well, don't we have, Ms. Ludyke receiving a doctor's opinion that it's a result of an adult grabbing the child?
She does receive an opinion from Riley Hospital from a doctor that is under contract to review such things. And this is a digital picture that is transmitted by email.
What day was that?
The day was...
She started out on a Friday night.
She gets the report back on January the 23rd.
What day is that?
Okay, they went to the... Detective Bright saw the child on the 18th, and then they take the child to the hospital that night. In other words, they go right to the hospital that night to see the local doctor. And the doctor can't make any determination, doesn't suggest any care, do anything about it, no medical care, no medical treatment. It's not a serious injury. So then Detective Wright returns his report over to the caseworker, and the caseworker says, well, let's send the picture to Riley. And she gets the results back on January the 23rd. So
that's a Wednesday.
That's a Wednesday. Right. So then on Thursday, which is what we believe happened, is that they learn about this other case that Mark was involved in 2003, some 5 years earlier with a teenage stepdaughter.
And that was a significant child abuse case, wasn't it?
Well, it's not.
Well, it's a child abuse case. Let's put it that way, isn't it?
No, I don't
it's
think
not.
Well, that's what I'm. You asked me. I'm telling you. Here's what I think When you have a child abuse case, there is either a judicial finding of child abuse or there is an admission of child abuse. The fact that there was discipline or a disagreement and there was physical force used is not child abuse. If that were true, my father and my mother would have been in prison for 20 years using a switch and a paddle. That is not child abuse just because there is a dispute with a teenage child. So I think the court never found anything, no legal finding of child abuse. There was an adjudication in which the whole family was involved to resolve this tension between a stepchild and Mark and Teresa. Family tensions, that's all it was. So I don't consider this child abuse. And I think had they talked to Mark and Teresa, which they did not do, Judge, they would have found out that it wasn't child abuse. So that's, you know, I'm respectfully disagreeing with you, but I don't think that plays into it. Teresa believes that they were called by Ludeke on the 24th, although her Ludeke's time log says the 24th. I'm sorry, she was called on the 24th. Time log says 25th. I don't think that's too relevant. But in either case, when Ludeke called Teresa or Mark, she had the information about this other event involving Mark, and it was never discussed. There was no attempt to sort of look into this. So the question, which we think is raised here, is if this case is allowed to stand based upon these very flimsy facts, which a police officer says doesn't constitute child abuse because it looks like a bite, and which the judge, when he has a hearing, says is not even constitute probable cause, and he said you specifically and deliberately chose not to come to court, and it wasn't late in the evening, and it was late in the day, but courts are open 24 hours, 7 days a week for emergency requests for orders in our state, and I think in most states. And there's always been, I used to be a caseworker, I used to be a child protective services attorney, so I know the process. This is not something that you have to, you know, work from 8 to 5. You can reach a judge anytime you want. So he was, if you had the voice, you would see that he was pretty angry about the caseworkers jumping the gun on this. And he said, you can still investigate if you want. And they did. And what did they do? They took the, continued with the investigation, didn't find anything, except when they took the depositions of the Woods, there was at least the appearance of deception, if not, you know, actual deception. So they were a little ambiguous about whether or not that polygraph proved that.
When did they suggest the polygraph?
That was after the court ordered the child returned to the family. So it was several days later. And they could have perhaps done it earlier because that was within the circle of suspects. In other words, originally they said it's anybody. It could be the Woods, husband and wife. It could be Mark and Teresa. But when they went to court, that whole circle changed, and the only one they wanted removed from the home was Mark. That was the petition that they filed. So initially it was, Teresa, you can't have contact without supervision. Mark, you can't even go there without supervision. And we're not going to tell you about the hearing. They did finally at the last minute, but only because Detective Bright said something's not right here and called them up to alert them to the hearing did they show up in time. Otherwise, it's a good chance they wouldn't have been able to get there. So if there is no limits on what the threshold is for a caseworker to remove a child without judicial review, we wouldn't have a case if they'd gone to court. If there's no limits, then you might as well just announce that. You might as well just say caseworkers in this state and in this circuit can do whatever they want because the spectrum is simply not going to be examined about whether or not there's protections under the Constitution for the family and the child. And we believe that there should be. Would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I can, for rebuttal.
Mr. Steiner?
May it please the Court. We take the position that the trial judge was really exactly right about how he looked at this case, and that this is a, I think, really a classic case where qualified immunity is appropriate. Qualified immunity is not disfavored at all. In fact, when the concept is raised, it's the burden of the plaintiff to show that qualified immunity is not appropriate for that particular case. And here, the plaintiff has failed to do that. I think we need to look at, really look closely at the facts and see that the two caseworkers involved here, Ludeke and Suttle, were actually very diligent about trying to investigate this thing properly and to protect the child when they gained some information that suggested the child could be in danger.
I thought I recalled someplace where there were photographs of the stepdaughter
that
saw that convinced them that she was subject to child abuse by Mark.
There were records in the file when they obtained the file from the previous case, and that occurred shortly before they made the decision that they wanted there to be some protection for the child. There were photographs in that file, and those photographs showed some fairly serious bruising to various parts of the stepdaughter's body that had been taken at the time of that other incident. So they had that in the file. Plus they had in that file the determination that was made by the Department of Child Services that, you know, what they call a substantiated child abuse at that particular time.
Mr. Steiner, on Wednesday, as I understand it, the case manager gets this doctor's opinion. And on Thursday, the examination is made of these files.
I think the files were really examined on Friday.
On Friday?
The file was received, you know, obtained by I think, Ms. Ludeke on Thursday, apparently. But they didn't really look closely at the evidence. They actually had a meeting, finally, of various persons, you know, in the office to discuss this situation that ended somewhere mid-afternoon on Friday.
So, to Mr. Sutherland's raising of the issue of timing, of availability of courts, do you have a response to the decision to move in advance of a hearing?
Well, yes, a couple of things. And I don't know whether, you know, there's not a lot in the record that establishes that court was going to be open after 4 or 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon.
I ask you to take judicial notice of the procedures
in Indiana. Mr. Sutherland has suggested that, but there isn't anything in the record that said that the judge was actually available, you know, after 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon. In order to put something together in writing after that decision was made that we need to act to protect this child, to actually get on the docket, the caseworkers indicated in their, at the district court level that they did not believe that they were going to be able to get a determination from the trial judge when they acted, and that is the reason why they decided to act on their own. There's some authority under Indiana law that in some circumstances they can act without a judicial order because, of course, we are concerned about, you know, protecting children in a lot of different circumstances where you might not be able to get a judge's order at a particular time. That was a judgment call, I'd say, on their part. A judgment call along with a lot of other judgment calls that they had to make as they were going through this thing. Let me go back to, let's just start at the beginning a little bit, walk it back a little bit and go to the beginning and think about what went on here. Sullivans kind of suggest that this wasn't really a serious matter that was being investigated. Well, the only reason why the matter was being investigated in the first place is because the Sullivans made it into a very serious matter. When Mrs. Sullivan noticed the bruising on the child on, I believe it was on the 16th, she then talked to her husband about it, and he said he didn't know how the bruises had gotten there, but they thought those bruises were serious enough that they went to the police department, and they filed a complaint against the babysitter, Wood, indicating they believed that child abuse had occurred. And, in fact, somewhere along the line, photographs were taken Now, there was some indication that somehow Ms. Ludicky didn't do everything that she could. Well, the very day or the next day after she was made aware of this case, she came to the Sullivan house and she talked to Mr. Sullivan. And she talked to the child. And she looked at the child. And she talked to mom on the telephone. And she asked mom, let's take this child to a doctor to be evaluated so that, you know, we can get some determination of maybe about how this might have occurred or what these injuries, you know, what were the cause of these injuries. And she did that. Mom took the child, the two-year-old, to the hospital. That particular doctor just didn't offer any opinion whatsoever about the cause, you know. But then the DCS worker, Ludicky, she didn't just leave it at that. She knew that they had a expert at Riley Hospital, which is a good hospital in Indianapolis for children, on staff, sent the photographs that they had of the injuries, the bruising to the child, to the doctor. The doctor said, this looks like an adult did this to me. You know, and essentially the opinion of that doctor was that there had been abuse by an adult. So at that point, we only know, that, so far as the caseworkers know, there's only three adults that had contact with the child at about that time when these injuries apparently occurred. The babysitter would, and mom and dad. So on the Wednesday, you get this report back. Let me take even a step back. Other things were done. There was contact made with other parents who had their children with this babysitter would. And those parents reported that they were very pleased with Wood's, you know, babysitting of their children, that they had no complaints whatsoever. Wood had been interviewed. There was nothing from those interviews, nothing from the investigation of her that in any way suggested that she had any background that suggested she had ever abused children, had ever been, you know, convicted of a crime or had any problems whatsoever. She had an explanation for that was very reasonable about what had happened during the day in question before mom had given the child a bath. So they have all of that information, but they have something here that was very much different than this Croft case that the plaintiffs had proffered, you know, during the trial. They had a real incident of abuse or apparent abuse by an adult against this child. So that makes it much different than Croft. I mean, the real problem in Croft was that the caseworker there didn't even know whether the child had been abused, yet starts taking pretty drastic actions along the way. In any event, you have all this information. And then they do get this file with photographs from the previous incident involving Mark Sullivan, and past is not always prologue, but sometimes it is. It's enough that when you're dealing with children and you're concerned about protection, that maybe you need to think about these kind of things. They got to the point where they looked at all the evidence on the Friday afternoon, and they had a situation where they'd been told by a reputable doctor that the injury was apparently caused by an adult. They knew who the adults were. They were still suspicious of Wood. They hadn't ruled Wood out, but Wood was no longer having any contact with the child at that point in time. The parents had made it very clear they weren't going back to Wood as a babysitter, so there wasn't any concern. There wasn't any need for DCS to take any action to separate the child from Wood. But the parents, particularly Mark, but mom couldn't be ruled out at that point in time either, could have been, and that was the view of the caseworkers. They came to the conclusion that child was potentially in some danger if that child was left solely in the custody of the parents at that point in time.
Well, the custody was primarily with Mark, wasn't it? I understand that he was laid off and he's home, or he's on disability or something. He's home with the child. It's not with both parents.
Well, that's correct. I mean, in saying that there's custody of both, of course, mom's home in the evening. Mom worked, and so she was gone during the day. Mark was there at home with the child, you know, most of the time. So the concern might have been primarily with Mark, but they were still concerned. The primary concern, clearly, from the record in this case of Ludicky and Suttle, who are the, you know, the defendants, was that the child was in danger, because we had had a previous incident just recently where the child had been abused. And their concern was that child needed to be protected. It was late in the day. It was their judgment call that they couldn't get get action from the court quick enough to get the protection they wanted for the child, at least up to the point where they have a hearing before the judge. So Ludicky goes to the home with some police officers. They did not have a warrant. They did not enter the house. Ludicky merely talked to Mr. Sullivan at the door and explained that she wanted to protect the child. She was there. She would like to take the child because they wanted to protect the child. And a dialogue began. And it started with the dialogue between Ludicky and Mr. Sullivan. Then Mrs. Sullivan was brought in by telephone. Ludicky told her that the decision had been a collective decision, that she should talk to her supervisor, Suttle. Mrs. Sullivan then talked to Suttle on the telephone, and in a fairly short order, they actually came to a resolution of the matter, an agreement. They came up with the idea, let's do a safety plan. The DCS permitted and was satisfied with the child being taken to the grandmother's house that was just across the border from Indiana over in Ohio, and a DCS worker would go there and make sure that everything was fine. Both mom and dad, Mark and Mrs. Sullivan, signed the safety order. When they got over to Ohio, Grandma signed the safety order, and essentially the safety order just required that Grandma be present when Mom and Dad were with the child.
He did not stay there, right?
He could have.
Oh, he could have?
They did not require Mark Sullivan to go anywhere at that point in time. They had initially suggested that, you know, that initially they came to take the child, to protect the child. But when they began dialoguing with the parents, they quickly came to the conclusion that they could take the child to a responsible relative. In this case, it was Mark's mom. And as long as mom indicated that she would be responsible for the child and be present when mom or dad were interacting with the child over the weekend, DCS was fine with that. And that was essentially what was worked out. They did not require Mark to stay in Indiana and not have any contact with the child. They did not require mom to stay in Indiana and not have any contact with the child. They could have been with their child all weekend, so far as that safety agreement was concerned. They may have been. I don't know.
Teresa stayed there, right? Teresa stayed there the weekend.
I understand she did go over there, and I believe she was there. Then the next day, a lady from the DCS went over and checked on the situation, actually told her that there was going to be a hearing the next week regarding the matter, you know, over in Indiana. And so, they did, before the hearing, even the DCS did tell the parents, and the parents were at the hearing and were allowed to speak. So I think that there's a lot of evidence here indicating that there was a careful investigation. There was reason on the part of the parents to believe that the child was in danger, and they took action. So in that situation, I think the judge was quite correct. District court judge was quite correct to understand that there ought to be qualified immunity in this case. This is a classic case of a judgment call. And if we look at the decisions from this circuit, and there are many of them, the few other decisions, you clearly recognize that when you have to make these kind of close calls, that generally that means that you're going to have qualified immunity, and that's really clearly the situation here. When the district judge talked about there being a 10-day period of time for the investigation, what he's really saying is, they did a lot of stuff in 10 days, And they learned stuff that indicated the child was, you know, at risk, and they took action. They made some judgments. It wouldn't support a claim under the Fourth Amendment in this kind of situation. Their actions were reasonable. Certainly wasn't so outrageous to be a substantive due process violation. And they had a hearing very promptly after the safety plan was in effect the next Monday. So there's no violation of procedural due process. We had a good post deprivation process here. The judgment of the
procedural due process challenges. Should there have been a hearing Friday night or Saturday, or if that's all available?
But generally, when we look at procedural due process, we look, you know, it can be either, you know, pre or post deprivation. Post deprivation is most appropriate, you know, can be appropriate. Here we had that. We also had this safety plan where the parents were not yanked away from their child. And so I urge the court to affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Sutherland? One, but you may have two.
Thank you. I would like to sort of reiterate that that the caseworkers don't operate in a vacuum. And when Mr. Steiner referred to in the state of Indiana does allow for exceptions, that's true. Every state does. And that's emergency and exigent circumstances. That's the exception. And then it's been confused with, well, probable cause with what a police officer has. If he has probable cause, he can make an arrest without a warrant. But here we're talking about doing something else. We're talking about removing a child. I don't think there's any question about that from the record, that this was a coerced decision or contract imposed upon the Sullivans. What Judge Dalhanty did was he said, well, now let's look at the statute. That's what you guys are supposed to do. Let's look at the statute. Let's go down the Indiana statute and see what we've got here. And he went through it with them. It's in the record. He says, you haven't got it. He says, you spent 10 days. Doesn't matter whether you spent 10 days or 5 days or 6 days or 60 days. You haven't got it. And if you'd have come to me, I would have denied the warrant. If that isn't a standard for us to look at, the common sense approach, then I don't know what is. This moving goalpost of qualified immunity, which applies only if you can find an analogous case, doesn't seem to apply to the trial judge who's right there applying common sense and looking at the statute. And so you have this dichotomy, which I'm really bothered by, because it seems to suggest that the caseworkers, it invites the caseworkers to ignore the court and say, as Mr. Steiner does, we have to make these calls. Maybe we made the wrong one. They don't even suggest they had probable cause.
Did the state court judge suggest that they just were short of the sufficiency of the evidence? He didn't make a finding of no abuse, did he?
What he asked, and it's in the transcript there, what he said is, Ms. Ludicky, how are you reaching this conclusion that there's a violation, that the child is in need of services because of abuse? And she says, because Mark had access. Is that it? That's it.
Well, had the caseworker presented the evidence, it was a Dr. Lasky's assessment that an adult had inflicted whatever bruise occurred?
I think the caseworker did give a history. That's true. There is all of that. But that doesn't mean that that injury was the only, or that opinion was the only evidence. In other words, Dr. And Riley was looking at a picture. The doctor at Reed, which was a local hospital, actually looked at the patient. So it was much more, I think, valuable opinion if he couldn't conclude what it was. And then most critically, Detective Wright, who gave an affidavit, said he's had all this experience himself in child abuse cases, and it looked like a bite mark to him.
Well, so, but that doesn't if not fall away, has to be weighed against a medical professional making a different assessment. I don't want to challenge the experience of the officer with the bite mark assessment, but we do have this assessment of a medical professional to the contrary.
That's true, and that information was presented to Judge Dalhanty as well, and he didn't find that persuasive. I mean, you still have to connect what looks to be an injury with a crime. I mean, you can't just say, oh, you got a bruise here, five adults have access, and then you have to say, well, somebody must be responsible. But maybe it's not somebody. Maybe it's a child who got into a fight at the daycare.
What do you say, Mr. Sutherland, to Mr. Steiner's position on the procedural due process challenge that dispatch was had in the sense that Monday the court proceedings began?
Well, that's a fairly quick hearing. I'll give you that. And but it was supposed to be an ex parte hearing, and the record's clear on that. They showed up, and Ms. Gibson, who was a caseworker, went there over to Ohio, said there's simply going to be a hearing. She had no idea what day it was. She had no idea what time it was. And they called to tell them late in the day, late in the morning, before noon, as I recall, around noontime, that there was going to be a hearing, which was at 2:30. But Mark had called to get the time himself, so he knew when it was, and he was making plans. Now, he can't see, so he can't drive. So once you move the child away, now you've got some issues here about how he's going to see his child. And that's a little hard to do when you have
You know, I appreciate, I think, the tensions that attended this area of the law. And I'm sure you do because you reference your background in casework. And the sanctity of the family and the privacy. Is this case at all ameliorated by the compromise that's arrived at, that it isn't the wholesale removal of the child to a state institution, but instead, I'm now thinking in the qualified immunity context, that they arrive at this depositing, if you will, of the child with a family member. Does that speak at all to the reasonableness of what the caseworkers were about? And I'm not in any way challenging your position on that the hearing should have been had.
You know, my experience both as a caseworker and as an attorney tells me that this sort of compromise is set up many, many times. In fact, it's the preferred compromise because, one, it costs the state money to place them in foster care. Two, it really upsets the child to put new people in his environment that he doesn't know. So it's done a lot. But the reality is that it limits the access of the child because you have to ensure that there's somebody there to supervise and there's somebody there that's available all the time. So you got transportation issues and so forth. So it is an interference. Now, does this impact on qualified immunity? I don't think so. What we're talking about here is that this could have gone on for a long time. And if they got into a situation where Judge Delhaney wasn't contacted on Monday, remember, this was an ex parte hearing. He allowed them to talk. They stood up. They weren't even actually under oath. They were just giving additional information. So he wasn't really basing his decision on what they had to say, I would assume, but he was basing it upon what the caseworkers had to say. I don't know. But we really think that his review of that is sort of the reasonable approach that this court should apply when you look at these so-called good faith judgments. This isn't even a close call to me. It's a closer call when you have serious injury and you have to sort of rely upon the exigent circumstance standard.
Is it a matter of serious injury or the potential for serious injury?
Well, if you walk out the street, there's a potential. You know, so just because Mark had something in 2003 with an adult teenager is not to me much evidence, and I don't think Judge Delhaney had that information as well. He didn't think it was much evidence. I mean, all of us who have teenage kids, you know, can try to explain anyways, you know, sometimes a physical confrontation. That doesn't make you a child abuser. It just doesn't. And I think that that involves an accusation of criminal behavior, and we're really talking about something that just happened. You know, a child bites her, Mr. Sullivan's thumb, and he's trying to get his thumb out. That's not, you know, that's where we're going. I do hope this court looks real carefully because this is going to send a signal if this is allowed to stand, and I don't want the court to go that way if possible. But I respect that this is a difficult call. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sullivan. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. The case is taken under advisement.